how many flags do we have to hand to parents and spouses and try to explain why they died?
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio and the second part of our interview with Chuck Luther, founder of the soldiers' support group Disposable Warriors, disposablewarriors.com. The name is derived from Chuck Luther's personal experience in Iraq, where he says he felt like a disposable warrior. Chuck Luther was serving in Taji, Iraq during 2006 and 2007 under major combat conditions when he sustained invisible wounds of war, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and a likely TBI, traumatic brain injury. After many sleepless nights, nightmares, headaches, bouts of anger, and other symptoms, Luther asked for help. He was then sent to an aid station, where for 5 weeks he endured ridicule and low rations. A social worker misdiagnosed him as a Chapter 513 personality disorder. The hasty medical decision by a non-doctor gave the military the language they needed to drum Chuck Luther out without having to give him benefits.
They put us through a tremendous amount of mental and psychological stresses because of the types of wars that we're waging currently. And when it takes a toll, they didn't prepare to fix us whenever we break, so it's easier to throw us away and make us a disposable warrior versus a fixable warrior and just put a new young man or woman from a high school off from a nice bonus and throw them out there and just replace them, retrain them, and use them until they break. And that's the cycle that we're in now, disposable warriors.
In part one of our interview, Chuck Luther explained that he was under serious pressure after being mistreated in Iraq, and he had thoughts of suicide. Luckily, he envisioned a new mission for himself instead. He would help himself and then work to help other soldiers avoid suicide by founding a SAG, Soldiers Advocacy Group. Chuck Luther had been based at Fort Hood in Texas for the military before heading out to Iraq. Now he runs the group Disposable Warriors in the Fort Hood area. He advocates for others who may have been misdiagnosed and have mental, behavioral, or physical health issues to sort out. Often under these conditions, the military will withhold pay or demand reenlistment bonuses back, as in the case of a soldier named Boyle who was asked to return $18,500. Normally, Chuck Luther told us, soldiers will fulfill their part of their contract with the military. He now is demanding that the military fulfill theirs.
I have yet to see soldiers, airmen, marine, or seamen not fulfill their obligation once they get to battle, because you're there. You have to. It doesn't matter if you're anti-war or not. You are there. And when you have a man shoot an RPG at you and watching your buddies die around you, you will fight. I don't care how much anti you are. You will want to live to get home to fight against what is going wrong. Well, there's a lot of things going on. In my case, Sergeant Boyle's case, I can name tons of them off. You can pull the internet up and see they're not doing their part of the bargain. The military is not. They're not honoring their part of the contract, and they're not taking care of us. They are throwing us away unless we have some radical changes in our mental health system, in our medical system, in the whole integrity of the military as a whole. Unfortunately, the five Novembers at Fort Hood, Texas, are not going to stop. That was one of the greatest tragedies, I think, that I've seen in my time as 39 years on this earth that could have been avoided several times over. But because it would have gotten in the way of progress, I think we turned a blind eye, and now we have 13 lives lost, 30 changed, one life ruined, and thousands here at Fort Hood. I don't even like going on post myself now with PTSD, getting around a bunch of soldiers. You just don't know if a soldier has been ridiculed, harassed, or beat up. Is he at that snapping point? And obviously, we've seen that soldiers can get firearms on military bases that they feel have betrayed them. So unless we do something radical, unless we start reaching out and touching, it's just a downward spiral. And I demand of the president and everybody that has an influential decision-making use of what's going on in our military with our young men and women to stand up and say, fine, we're going to fight a war, but we're going to do it the right way. That's a demand that has to be met. It's not negotiable. It's not if we think about it. It has to happen. And that's why people like myself, Paul Sullivan, the Given Hour Foundation, IVAW, that's where we all come from, is because we all have different views, but we have the same goals of enough is enough.
In a Thanksgiving message, President Obama said it was time to remember those who cannot sit down to break bread with those they love. He was talking about casualties from the Iraq and Afghan wars. We're focusing on soldiers from these wars who feel so overwhelmed by them that they have sustained invisible wounds and commit suicide. It is an act of irrational desire for change, an attempt to eradicate pain, and most often it's attempted under conditions of extreme stress when people are not themselves and they behave irrationally and compulsively. The conditions of these two occupations have produced astounding numbers of casualties from suicide. In January of 2009, even as President Barack Obama was taking the oath of office, the Army had finally released some of the shocking news of suicides in U.S. soldiers that month. According to the Army, 24 soldiers had killed themselves in January alone. It was a number 6 times higher than the statistic in 2008. It was also higher than the number of soldiers killed in combat. According to a CNN story, a U.S. Army official said, quote, "This is terrifying. We do not know what's going on." But is that really true? Certainly the military has had many cases of suicide to study at this point. Hundreds of U.S. soldiers have killed themselves, and others have done so without having their deaths counted as a suicide. They are, quote, "pending investigation," said Chuck Luther. In his Thanksgiving message, President Obama also went on to say, "We should remember the soldier who is, quote, overseas, holding down a lonely post and missing his kids, the sailor who left her home to serve a higher calling, the folks who must spend Thanksgiving apart from their families to work a second job so they can keep food on the table or send a child to school." It was a touching message. The president said he was grateful beyond words for the service and hard work of U.S. soldiers. And he said, quote, "This year, we know that far too many face a daily struggle that puts the comfort and security we all deserve painfully out of reach." For the families of soldiers who've killed themselves, the president has not seen their pain clearly enough. He has refused to sign a White House condolence letter to them, as he does in cases of soldiers killed in combat. The families complained in a New York Times story, November 25th, by James Dow. This is the voice of Sergeant Jacob Blalick. Erica Good provided a video to the New York Times, which appeared alongside of Dow's story.
Hey, it's Jackie. It's the 20th of April. We go home in 6 days. I lost two good friends on the 14th. I'm having a hard time dealing with it.
And she offered a portrait of a young soldier named Sergeant Blalock, who was so haunted by the memory of his fellow comrades that he took his own life. But Sergeant Blalock was also a victim of repeated IED blasts, the kind that often lead to traumatic brain injury and erratic behavior. In a Pacifica special for Sprouts, a grieving father, Charles McKinney, told us he wanted better aftercare for any soldier who sustained a blast injury and may have sustained brain injury.
You know, he had his dreams, and he didn't get to fulfill his dreams because of the effects, we feel like, primarily of traumatic brain injury. He had suffered several IEDs his first tour. He was in Bradley fighting vehicles, and his Bradley got hit several times, and he was fortunate, and no one was wounded bad, no one died, and he used to laugh and call himself the EOD, which is Explosive Ordnance Disposal, because he could find them and blow them up and not kill anybody in his unit, in his vehicle.
Sergeant Jeff McKinney sustained repeated traumatic brain injuries from IED explosions and showed profound symptoms afterward.
But we think the percussions of those blasts, the blast caused traumatic brain injury to him, and I think he sat there for a year while he was home, and then he had to go back again. There was like several days before he died. He was in a Humvee, and they hit a huge IED. It blew up 2 feet in front of him and just rocked their vehicle. And the men with him in the vehicle said that had it hit the vehicle, it would have all been dead. And the medic seemed to think that triggered the really effective Jeff there, that brain injury there, plus the horrendous losses that the unit was taking. His battalion lost 31 men on that tour there, most since Vietnam for one battalion. And Jeff was pulling dead bodies and seeing things, you know, that just, I think he felt like he was the father, and he had to take care of these young men, and he couldn't, and he couldn't do anything about it, and it was just, he didn't know how to recognize the symptoms of what he was going through, and he didn't know what to do about it.
With psychotropic drugs in his system, he had been sleep-deprived and traumatized. He had been having blackouts. He had been showing signs of depression. And one final IED blast hit him before he finally put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger in front of soldiers in his command. Jeff McKinney had been having some of the same symptoms Chuck Luther described on his website, DisposableWarriors.com. They're symptoms of stress. They're the symptoms of PTSD. And Chuck Luther said he contemplated doing the very same thing that Jeff McKinney did, but he managed to survive. The McKinney family, Chuck Luther, and others are now calling on the White House and the military to implement emergency-level changes in the way soldiers are treated. As some 30 to 40,000 more U.S. soldiers deploy to Afghanistan, the policy of how soldiers with symptoms of PTSD are treated must be implemented immediately, they say, lest more soldiers die from these invisible wounds. The warning signs of traumatic brain injury or PTSD and other stress reactions should be something every soldier knows and every soldier is trained to respond to save his fellow soldier. Instead of this kind of policy, the U.S. military has a well-established practice of denying claims of PTSD automatically. Some say it's to avoid the high cost of treatment for these soldiers. And it's clear that this has been discussed as policy, not as an accident or coincidence in these cases. In 2008, Dr. Norma Perez, a mental health integration specialist at the VA's Medical Center in Temple, Texas, wrote an email that is now infamous. She said, quote, "Given that we're having more and more compensation-seeking veterans, I'd like to suggest that you refrain from giving a diagnosis of PTSD straight out. Consider a diagnosis of adjustment disorder," she said. In his report on Chuck Luther's Disposable Warriors Project at Fort Hood, journalist Dar Jamail pointed out that the November 5th shootings there were something Luther feared. He wrote that 2 months before the shootings, Luther had warned the Army's chain of command that dramatic changes were needed, or else a soldier might kill other soldiers. It was something that had already happened in May in Baghdad, when a soldier named Russell killed 5 people at a stress clinic he was attending there. We asked Chuck Luther if he thought the military turned a blind eye to the problems of Major Hassan and at the base in general, because they just wanted to keep things moving forward with the war and deployment of troops in general.
I think so. You know, it's really a touchy situation, I know, with a lot of people. You know, if they were to have gone back a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, whatever it is that they're even reporting in the media and in the news, that Major Hassan had did a PowerPoint. He spoke out. His peers had told the supervisors and the higher-ups, hey, listen, something's wrong here. This guy's not right. You know, I believe that if they would have stood up and said, wow, could you imagine with us fighting a war in 2 countries that are predominantly Muslim and Islamic, that we would have come out in the media a year and a half ago and said, we've exited a psychiatric mental health professional from the military because he's Muslim and has strong Muslim beliefs and does not believe in the wars in Iraq. You know how devastating that would have been for our fight to continue on? Do you know how many people in the world would have gotten really angry to hear that? That even our own soldiers, our own officers, our leaders, are not agreeing with what's going on. And unfortunately, the shooter the day of 5 November allegedly was Major Hassan, and unfortunately, he was Muslim. If he would have been an African-American soldier, if he were a Jewish soldier, I don't think we would be here. It's just unfortunate that he was Muslim. And I think that, the Army doesn't react until it has to. That's the one thing I've learned about it. It will not react unless it has to. Like over in Iraq, prime example in my case, they had told me that I was going to stay in the aid station for the last 6 months of our 15-month tour, and then when I got home, they were going to deal with me. Only after that, whenever I spiraled downward even more so and got very suicidal, did they realize they needed to get me out of there, because could you imagine the answers that they would have had to come to, because my wife and my senators here knew about. some of what was going on, not the whole truth. If they would have got a phone call that I had committed suicide over there when it was already known, it's, you know, it's the whole plausible deniability thing. You know, if you don't know about it, then you're not accountable for it. But once you're aware of the situation, you're fully accountable. And Lord knows you don't want to fall in that category of looking and going, wow, well, we knew, but why didn't we do something? Hence, the Army at this juncture with Hassan. So I believe they allow some things to go on further, and now we paint it out not that he was extremely upset about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, that he didn't think they were right wars, and that after counseling soldier after soldier after soldier and hearing the horrific things coming out of those countries, I don't think the Army wanted him to be able to talk anymore. So if he does explode and flip out, or if he just goes AWOL, well, then he's just an extremist Muslim that was a jihadist, and I don't buy into all that. I don't buy that he was all those things, because I know a little bit more about Islamic extremist jihadists, because we lived on the streets and in the villages with them in Iraq for 9 months, and everything that I know about Muslims that want to martyr themselves and fight against America and the great Satan, they call us, and stuff like that, are carried out in totally different ways. They're not just out of the blue, I'm going to get coffee at 6:30 in the morning at 7-Eleven and eat hash browns, and then, you know, 7.5 hours later, I'm going to commit 13 counts of murder. It just doesn't add up. So I believe that all the way back to September 11th, we had credible intelligence that there was going to be an attack. We didn't know the exact specifics of the time, the place, and the origin, but we knew it was going to happen. And instead of stepping in and stepping up our security, we stood down. And then we stood by, and we watched a horrific action happen, and then we scurried to say what's happened. Then we used the American emotion of what's happened to turn it around and then blame somebody for it. And it's just a follow-through again. Here we are again. And unfortunately, it happened with an Army officer on an Army base.
You're listening to a Talk Nation radio special, taped during the week of Thanksgiving 2009. Just prior to the start of the holiday season, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke from Afghanistan about America's mission there. Her words held clues as to the likely time frame for benchmarks the White House is expected to announce about America's role. Reading between the lines of what she said, it seems America's role is likely to go on for at least 5 years. That just to achieve sufficient security to control Afghanistan.
And I was very pleased to hear today when President Karzai said that he hopes that within 3 years, the Afghan security forces will have the lead in important areas, and within 5 years, which is an ambitious goal, but he stated it, the Afghan security forces would have the lead throughout the country.
The Obama administration appears to be soft-pedaling the number of years America will occupy Afghanistan, and they're under pressure from left, right, and center on the unpopular Afghan and Iraq wars. But the military escalation and further deployment has been going on behind the scenes of rhetoric about Obama taking time to make a decision.
And my only point is, it's not too late.
An ABC News Green Room segment the network put online sheds light on the dilemma.
You know, we still have a chance. General McChrystal has laid out a counterinsurgency strategy that would allow us to go in and secure key areas in order to provide the kind of security those villagers need to know they can fight off the Taliban.
Former State Department official Elizabeth Cheney, a leading Republican neoconservative on Mideast policy, is in discussion with former Treasury Secretary Robert Reich and journalist Walter Isaacson. Even the conservative George Will was more skeptical about the wisdom of the current Afghan policy than Liz Cheney, who was, after all, sent to the Mideast by her father, former Vice President Dick Cheney and President Bush, to do public relations work. She commented on the impression people might have of the U.S. operation in Afghanistan.
Actually, what happens in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan, where we've gone in, we've taken down the government, we've got a new government in place, if we are not providing security, the people say, well, wait a minute, America is very powerful. Mm-hmm. You're occupying us and you're not providing security.
You have five countries in that region, all of whom really do not want a radical Sunni Taliban regime there. You have India, you have China, You even have Iran, you certainly have Russia, and you certainly have Pakistan. So I do not think it should be our sole responsibility to occupy and hold large swatches of territory there. We should encourage a whole lot of people to say the Taliban's not in your interest.
Chuck Luther, I wanted to ask you what you thought about this ABC segment, because it seemed as if Elizabeth Cheney was articulating a need for America to provide security for Afghanistan, and in a way, there was a public relations angle there, you know, that we're worried about the way we're perceived in the region, and then the conversation about whether or not we can do it. But for soldiers on the ground in Afghanistan and in Iraq, it's a matter of life and death. And I think the question people want to know the answer to is it worth it?
Exactly. And, you know, I blame our administration, past and present, because, you know, initially after the September 11th attacks, and we ruled that Osama bin Laden had done it, and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and all these things, they had pretty credible evidence that that's where it was going. And, you know, I was all for, let's go to Afghanistan where these guys are and let's remove them. Let's arrest them. If we can't arrest them, if they're killed in battle, then, you know, let's deal with it. But at the time, I didn't understand fully the whole terrorist network thing. That, first of all, the day George W. Bush stood up and proclaimed a war on terrorism, I will give him some credit. He did legitimately say some truthful things. He did say it's going to be a long and costly war. Only did we know how long and how costly it would cost us and how long it would be. He claimed something that I believe from a tactical combat soldier perspective, that is, you cannot reach it. It's unattainable. You cannot win against terrorism, simply because it can be anywhere at any time. There are different acts of terrorism. So we went to there to Afghanistan, and we devoted, you know, that whole first month into just beating up on everything and everybody we could in Afghanistan, and we ran the Taliban out of control of their government. And then it seemed like we just let it go. And then February of the following year, we decide that we're going to do the shock and awe, and we're going after Saddam Hussein because of weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, there was never a complete link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, okay? I walked the streets of a lot of cities in Iraq over a nine-month span, and I promise you that I never saw one weapon of mass destruction. I never saw any nuclear, biological, chemical warfare that could harm the United States. I never saw any of that. But we kind of started the war on the right end, I think, you know, the whole war on terrorism, going after the people responsible for September 11th. That was the whole reason for these two occupations that we're currently in. That was the knee-jerk reaction. Other than that, if September 11th wouldn't happen, we would not be in both of those countries right now. So here we are in Afghanistan, and then we focus from 25 to 30,000 troops over there. We turn around and we pour in 160,000, 180,000 soldiers into this country of Iraq, and we stay there. And we leave alone what's going on in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'd made the comment, hey, I'd just soon go to Afghanistan because there's less stuff going on over there. I don't want to be here. This is crazy, you know, not knowing what day you're going to get blown up multiple times even. And so all we did was we created our own failure, because they used us as a training ground over in Iraq. They watched our every move, the enemy being terrorists, and they watched our every move. They watched how we react in a four-vehicle convoy. If they blow up the lead vehicle, how the next three vehicles are going to recover. They watched all of our tactical training. They watched how we're going to react to sniper attacks. They watched how we're going to combat multiple IED attacks, how we're going to attack and combat the RPG attacks and things like that, how we're going to train ourselves to be in that kind of a climate. They did all that, and they built back up over in Afghanistan. And you see exactly what I'm talking about is happening, because we are losing more soldiers at a greater rate per capita over there right now in Afghanistan than we ever did in Iraq, simply because they are trained and proficient, and we're fighting a war that we've never trained for. In all my military training, I never was trained in desert urban warfare, ever. And that's exactly what we're fighting. And we can go back to history. We had Russia tried to fight those same fighters in the hills of Afghanistan. And you see what happened after they finally repelled one of the greatest superpowers in the world back to their own country. And I think that's what's going to happen to us. We're going to come back with our tails between our legs eventually. there's not an attainable mission over there. We're not trying to secure a village that was overtaken by an enemy that's doing something bad to the population. The population, unfortunately, of the people that we fight against are the relatives of the fighters that we fight against. So it's inconceivable that we should even be there, and we're losing lives. How many flags do we have to hand to parents and spouses and try to explain why they died? I think it is not a war that we can win, nor is it even worth winning at this point.
Well, Chuck, we're speaking during Thanksgiving week, and your family, your kids, must be very thankful to have you home.
I have a 17, a 16-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 17-month-old. And my oldest is a boy. He's going to graduate high school this year. And, you know, he's had his go-round with, you know, maybe I should go in the Army. Maybe I should do what my dad did. And I don't tell him not to. I don't discourage him. I just tell him I want him to have a freedom of choice. I want him to be able to do the things that he aspires to do. He wants to be a computer scientist. He wants to program and write programs for computer software. And I said, hey, if that's what you want to do, I want you to be able to do it. Absolutely, I think they're all thankful at times with Dad being home this Thanksgiving. Me and my wife just spoke yesterday morning, and we got to spend a weird, unheard of couple hours together without interruption. And she said, you know, we just got word that one of our friends had been killed over in Iraq, so now there's a spouse and a small child that's going to be going through the rest of their life without their father and their husband. And, you know, she said, I'm just glad that you're home. I'm glad you made it through. And I said, yeah, I'm very thankful. I am thankful that we do live in the country that we live in. I'm thankful that there are people out there defending our safety and our freedoms. And I just hope that we can come together and realize that wars have to be fought, and then there's some that don't have to be. And we don't have to create wars just to say we can. And I just hope for my kids' sake that they can grow up in a peaceful world without war and death and all those bad things that we're witnessing right now, and the recession and the stresses of life, and that they can just be happy. And, you know, I'm actually in college now. Now that all my military service is over with, I'm actually going to college, using the money that I earned as a benefit of being in the military. And my favorite subject is government, because I like to read and listen to how we're supposed to be and see how far off we are right now. But, you know, our founding fathers just wanted a country that could be free of oppression because of religion or sex or background or financial status or any of those things. They just wanted us to be. And that's all that I can ask for now this Thanksgiving, is that maybe in the next 12 months to the next Thanksgiving, maybe we can get a little closer to that. And it all happens with each person changing. I was told by a senior leader in the military, said, you know what, you really don't matter to us because you're only one person and we're the Army. And I said, you are exactly right. I am only one person. And I said, and you are a big Army and you are the government and the military. So let me tell you something. When a lot of one people get together and they have had enough of it, a million people, individual voices speaking at one time are far louder. And guess what happens? The tide will change and we will overcome, not out of spite, but out of necessity of this is the right thing to do. And one last thing, when somebody asks me, why do I do what I do? I try to find some great answer. You know, I want it to sound really smart. I want it to sound good. I wanted it just to be a good sound bite, and I couldn't. After about 45 seconds, I said, you know, because it's the right thing to do. At the end of the day, when I go to sleep, I'm tired. I'm exhausted. But, you know, when I lay my head down, I know that I've done everything that I could that day. I don't worry about tomorrow or worry about what happened yesterday. It's that day to be the best man, best person that I could be, and hope that I have a breath the next morning to wake up and do it all over again. And that's just where we're at now, I guess.
DisposableWarriors.com is the website. Chuck Luther, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Yes, ma'am, you too.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
For more information about advocacy work for soldiers, log on to our website, talknationradio.org, and in the coming weeks, we'll post links to as many such groups as we can find. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.